is the Pedestrian Podcast.
I don't know. That's just what pedestrian, average, mediocre receivers do. What's up? What's up? My man Deion Sanders, we all right, huh? We all right? Yeah, we all right. We're going to go to the Super Bowl again, being all right.
The official podcast of the UK Seahawkers.
We are going to follow you. Gotcha, you lead us, gotcha, okay? Like I told you before, you lead us to darkness, we will follow you.
Here are your hosts, Stuart Court.
I'm probably wrong. I am wrong on a hell of a lot of things.
And Adam Nathan.
And I think if that's the philosophy you have going into every game, more often than not, if you score more points, you'll win.
Go Hawks.
Welcome to another episode of the Pedestrian Podcast, still the one only unofficial UK Seahawks podcast. The 2019 season started this past weekend, apparently. And to talk about that, myself, Stuart Court, is joined by, as ever, Mr. Adam Nathan. How are we, sir?
I'm doing very well. I was at times pushed on Sunday in my desire to remain positive at all times and to enjoy the season, I think was the quote. It wasn't necessarily the most enjoyable of days, but I think we predicted that was probably the way it was going to go anyway. So at least we got one part of it right.
Yeah, it's a case of the more things change, the more they stay the same, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, ever so slightly. I am fascinated, and we'll go on to this later on, by the idea that we were deliberately bad in order to save things for the harder games, in inverted commas. So I think maybe we'll have to explore that maybe as the podcast and the season goes on. But there's half full, and then there's that view. Maybe the two are intertwined. Let's see.
I think both of us commented it might do go after predictions over the weekend. People obviously on the Facebook group were saying it, and on this last week as well, we kind of laughed that this game would be like it was, but for it to actually be that way and that everything we kind of jovially nudged, wink, winked about, it's just, yeah, as you say, it's tough to not gripe and groan being 1-0 on the 2019 season.
I think you absolutely take it, especially with a bit of a pig of a run of fixtures coming up. So we absolutely take the win. Look, we knew it wasn't going to be pretty, so in a way, haven't really got a lot to moan about, have we?
No, not especially. But on the offense, we'll go over both sides of the ball. On the offensive side of the ball, it wasn't much cop and wasn't much fun. Russell Wilson finished the day 14 for 20, 196 and 2 touchdowns, and was sacked 4 times, which is another issue we will get onto later. But the biggest thing about those 14 for 20, Adam, is that 7 of the targets and led the team on targets was RB Chris Carson. I think you may have tweeted, you definitely messaged something about concerns about his usage. I mean, he touched the ball 22 times on Sunday, and the Seahawks only had, 40-odd plays on Sunday, and for him to touch it almost 60% is, again, something we heard them talk about in the summer and off-season and training camp, but for it actually to be come to fruition when others were almost passengers for large chunks of the game, it was slightly weird, wasn't it?
Yeah, I did find it alarming. As you say, they discussed over the off-season the intention to get running backs more targets, which is something that the analytics crowd really pounced on and said that was not the finest of ideas. whether you do or don't think that, difficult to say either way. But yeah. I was concerned in the sense that, you know, Carson in his third season now, obviously his first season was curtailed with an injury. The second season, I think he was pretty healthy the whole way through, but I think it's going to be unsustainable to use a player like that much. And not only is it unsustainable, he is a very good player. I would suggest that the usage that he was given on Sunday is what I'd expect of like a Zeke Elliott, Saquon Barkley, generational player. To want to use him that much to the expense of your other players. I mean, Tyler Lockett had 2 targets and not one until the fourth quarter. It felt a little bit vanilla. I'm hoping that that was just the plan for, you know, get through week one and work it out from there. But I'm not convinced that that is the way that they can hope to play through the rest of the season and thrive, because, you know, if we were playing against Bobby Wagner, I'm not sure we'd have scored a point.
No. But Chris Carson had touched the ball, as I said, 22 times for just 81 yards. Obviously, he got the two all-important scores, touchdowns. One was a one-yard run, and the catch and run was pretty impressive. But that's just 3.6 yards per touch. And again, on a pretty abject, I think, maybe that might be a bit harsh, offensive performance. Well, it definitely was comparative to what we gave up against the Bengals offense anyway. But 3.6 is not going to get the job done again. If this usage keeps going up, you kind of would be more accepting of the usage if he was, what, half a yard more maybe, getting over that 4.4 yards a touch range? Or is that just nitpicking to nitpick?
I don't think it's nitpicking. I think if you remember the Dallas game at home last season, there was a great celebration at the fact that we had a 100-yard rusher. But I think he ran the ball about 30 times, didn't he?
Yeah. So I think it was 27 and he 27 rushes and he got, was it 104?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't put, you know, ultimately, if I rushed it 100 times in a game, I'd hope to make, you know, maybe 3 yards. it's a bit basic to say that, like, X number of yards were achieved, ergo it was a good performance. I don't really think we made an awful lot of hay in the running game itself. I mean, as you say, obviously a one-yard touchdown, that's just good offensive line play. The catch and run was a very impressive play. But in terms of would you say that they got the running game going, which is what they want to do, or do they just do a lot of running?
No, but I think Pete Carroll mentioned on Monday, with if not Brock and Salk and his morning thing and his press conference as well, that they kind of just arrogance. Well, I think arrogance was the word he used. Just kept plodding along like they did the last time we saw this team in competitive game action. But for the 22 touches of the ball, he didn't have like the seminal play, did he? I mean, because if you look 24 hours later, and Kenny Stills has the what should have been and what could have been a game winning touchdown for the Texans, he only had one or two, maybe three catches, but he had that moment, if that makes sense.
Well, he's like an inverse Tyler Lockett.
Yeah. But yeah, exactly. But the fact he had 21 touches of the ball, and really the only thing you can really remember him doing, especially running the ball, was the final run he had when he sealed the game, iced the game pretty much. There's that arrogance and the fact that they kept on doing the same thing, and like was the old insanity thing where insanity is when you try. We keep trying the same thing over and over and expecting different results. I kind of felt, especially on the ground, what it kind of felt like watching it, because it was just the same old thing we've seen for the last 15, 16 months, isn't it?
Well, what do you reckon about that article that I referenced in the opener? I mean, for those that don't know, Mike
Beast Pod one,
yeah, Beast Pod Seahawk, yeah. Scout, I believe is his name on Twitter.
Yeah,
without wanting to, put words in his mouth too much, was that the article was almost suggesting that like the Seahawks always do this in games like that, so that when they face a Rams, when they go to New England in 2016, they've got another gear to go into, and kind of as a result, that's okay. What we had on Sunday, I think that there's a lot of value to that point. I just wonder how what's the end game if that's the way they want to be.
Yeah, I think there's a lot more value to it after Sunday, being because it's week one. But the other examples he used, which are like, I think was it San Francisco, then obviously the Chiefs Sunday night, mm-hmm. which we kind of just shut everything down against them. That is a bit weird, because it's if they're trying to hide things, but it's week 14, 15. I think Sunday carries a lot more weight because obviously it's week one and they don't want to unfurl too much what they're going to do. But week 13, 14, it's just a strange approach. But also it kind of just completely compass anything where we've heard for the last decade, where they treat every game the same, isn't it? We hear that from the players, but we heard it for years from Sherman and Wilson, go 1-0 every week and kind of thing. So if that is the case, and I say Mike does present it pretty validly and solidly, it kind of debunks a lot of things that Pete Carroll and the players try their best to preach and tower company line on, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think it also comes a part of the seam slightly when you look at the obviously end to last season against Dallas, where it's almost seemed like, well, that's what we are, and therefore we lost. But that didn't have to be how we were at all, really, did it?
No, it didn't. So
I think that's where things maybe can be, you know, you could push back on the argument slightly. But although I don't disagree with the overall premise that this is what a Pete Carroll team is going to be, whether you kind of like it or you don't. So it's interesting, and I don't know if we can take much of this game to next season for the rest of the season, because let's say you do. Let's say that game is an indicator for the rest of the season. Are you more or less positive now than you were a week ago for the future of the season?
Slightly.
I said more or less, so you can't just say slightly. I need one of those words.
Yeah, less.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think if that's where they're going to be, then I'd be less.
Because like me and you often, when we watch like the Sunday night or Monday night, we always talk like group chats and everything, how it's like a pang of jealousy when we watch Deshaun Watson go up and down the field against the Saints and how Drew Brees and that offense operates and how X, Y, Z offenses operate. Because they don't approach it this way, if this theory that Mike had is legit. They just kind of like, this is how we do things. Stop us. Like the Rams are the perfect example. Everyone knows what they're going to do. Everyone knows how they're going to run Gurley or Malcolm Brown or get the ball to Robert Woods and get the ball to Cooper Kupp. But they don't. They do what they do in week one, pretty much what they do in week 20 last season. They don't change it. They just it's up to the other defense to stop them. And last year, no one could. And the Panthers didn't seem like they could either on Sunday, which is another point. But it's just, I don't know.
How do you watch games on Sunday when the Seahawks are on? Because personally, I have the game on my laptop and I'm watching Red Zone at the same time on TV. And yeah, like, and I'm watching Red Zone on silent, and obviously have the Seahawks commentary. And yeah, like watching some of those teams play, like Dallas were on at the same time as us on Sunday. And it was pretty hard to watch, like, Kellen Moore just, you know, as everyone suggested he would, completely reinvigorate that offense. And I think I tweeted this out, like, maybe the way that the Seahawks are doing things is the right way, but it's pretty contrary to the way every other good team is trying to play right now. So it's interesting, and I guess they're going to have to live or die by that based on results. And they probably don't have any more passes now. This season is one that I would imagine they need to see something either way, because a third season, if they have the same season as last year, you would question whether you'd want to do that again, or if you're kind of edging towards football purgatory a touch.
Yeah, I mean, I think we said on the podcast a couple weeks ago, I think this season will be the same as last season. But when I said that, I meant like playoffs and maybe one done if we have to go on the road to one of the four division winners. I didn't mean or really expect it to be this way, because every move they made, even like the way they stacked the roster for the initial 53, suggested that this was going to be different. And then the inactive list comes out at 8:15 on Sunday, and it's got every single receiver apart from two. Mm-hmm. It seemed every receiver ever. I think Steve Largent was even on the inactive list on Sunday. But it just kind of, I think I read that and I kind of, okay, here we go, this is it. I think I messaged you or put on Twitter. Yeah, I kind of could do without this for the next 3 hours, kind of thing. It's kind of, you kind of, as soon as you saw that inactive list and the amount of wide receivers and that they had all four or five running backs and the fullback active, it kind of, it was deflating a little bit, because obviously you spend 7 months waiting for the game, and then you see that, and you're going, it's just going to be, because I watched this game in January, I don't really need to watch this game again. Does that make sense?
It does, but let's try and put a more positive spin on things, and I've landed you in this, so I've given you no prep for this, but I'm just thinking about like a game in my head that we'd play, that I'm going to list the negative things that I thought stood out from Sunday.
Okay.
And then let's try and work through the way in which it's just a week one thing, or we can say, no, that's going to be a problem, because I think that will give us a fairly good indication of how we can view the rest of the season. How about that? So I'm going to say that the first big worry and negative was the offensive line play. Is that something that you can see being improved? And is that maybe just a reps thing that, and in 2 or 3 weeks we'll be all right again?
Yeah, but I think, as I've posted on the Facebook group, the target for the angst on the offensive line is aimed at the wrong people.
Uh-huh.
I think Pro Football Focus have nailed it, and I mean we both follow Nathan Ertz on Twitter, and I think we shared a few of his clips he had. Justin Britt on Sunday was oof. And like I think Nathan said, if this is how he plays against Javon Hargrave and the Steelers this week, there's serious questions about his week 3, week 4 future, not just his 2020 and onwards future in Seattle. Because I think Pro Football Focus gave him a grade of 25.
Blimey.
And it's just, he, yay. I mean, obviously, if Eddie's just the cash cow for people, for detractors at this point, but he, without Jermaine Ifedi, that is, we're probably talking about Geno Smith playing on Sunday if it isn't for Jermaine Ifedi. Because Jermaine Ifedi, yes, he had a couple of penalties against him. I think he had, was it a hold and maybe one false start?
Yeah, I think so.
I think that sounds about right. And then he kind of did let one, I think Hubbard kind of took his dinner, but everything, a lot of it, Geno Atkins was absolutely having a career day against Justin Britt. And then there's a really funny clip, which again Nathan Ertz posted, where Dwayne Brown and Ethan Postage on the left have completely done their job, and then they both turn around at the same time, and Russell Wilson's on his back, and Fluker and Britt are just standing over him. It's kind of like the angst for the O-liners are aimed at the wrong place, but also at the same point, back to the point of your question, it kind of feels like it will and kind of has to change at the positions of annoyance on Sunday.
So what's your out of 10 optimism that it can change and get better?
7, because I think the players, like I said, I think Britt has been here enough. I think they trust him enough that he has to be better. Mm-hmm. But if we're here a week ago saying the same thing about the same person, then it's a bigger issue in 7 days than it is right now.
Okay, so the next thing that I would say is probably on the more negative side is that I think we got doubled in yards, in offensive yards. So let's say
452 to 268.
Okay, so 200-yard difference against a road team with Andy Dalton throwing a career high in numbers. So let's talk about a negative being how little they were able to kind of do offensively from a scheme point of view. Tyler Lockett having 2 targets, Tyler Lockett being the only wide receiver, I believe, to catch a pass, apart from DK Metcalf. Yep. And yeah, just the general offensive vanilla-ness. Give us a rating, and what do you reckon, how solvable that's going to be?
That was just the most unsurprising thing. I think Tyler Lockett said he was being doubled. He hadn't been doubled since he was at Kansas State. That is kind of probably going to be the way until if Metcalf backs that up this week, then it might change for Tyler Lockett. But we need, it's happened when you don't put the people out there. I think as we saw with, you saw it with Kyler Murray somewhat in the second half of that game against Detroit, where he started to throw the ball to Larry because they were just spreading them out consistently, and it kind of like the wear on the defensive backs kind of paid off for that team, although it was some unbelievable throws and catches and that, but that kind of was kind of what I'd expect, and I don't think that the only way it's going to change is if Metcalf continues to backs up what he did in week 1, but I think that's a little bit lower on my exuberance compared to this.
And the last thing I would say the last thing I'd say would be a big negative that I would take is the way in which the secondary played. Shaq Griffin aside, who I thought was excellent.
Yeah.
But again, allowing Andy Dalton to have 400 yards plus of passing against you
yeah.
for the first time in his career.
Yeah.
And, you know, Tedrick Thompson had the eye-catchingly bad play, although I'm not convinced it was all... He was that bad aside from that, but playing the whole game pretty much in base defense and very seldom utilizing the nickel yeah. that I thought they played on an awful lot. I mean, the color commentator on Sunday called John Ross's second touchdown before it even happened.
Yep.
Or a long play where it happened that, like, look, Kendricks is on a wide receiver and he's going to get burned every time. And he was.
Yeah.
So what do you reckon about that?
It's the same as kind of with defensive lack of targets for anyone. I think I said the secondary is where I was going to be focusing my attention to. It kind of felt like that was always going to happen. Earl Thomas matters, and he matters a hell of a lot to this team and this scheme kind of thing. Because, like, Tedrick Thompson, bless him, is not, and he's nowhere near the level of Earl, and he's never going to be, and he's shown nothing to be that center field guy over these spot starts over the last couple of years. He kind of it kind of did surprise, but the most concerning thing was although he got hosed a little bit by the PI, which is kind of one of those ticky-tacky things, but Trey Flowers kind of looked like a late round convert to play the new position kind of thing. And as you say, Shaq Griffin, that possibly is Shaq Griffin's best game since Sherman left. I think it's his best
game.
Yeah,
he held them together, didn't he?
He was. I mean, the fact that long pass breakup didn't... I mean, he went step to step with John Ross, who they torched the earth in Lucas Oil a couple of years ago at the Combine. He's been step for step with him. And there'll be a lot more conversation about Shaq Griffin if that player had counted, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Well, those are my three things. And
yeah.
I think overall, I think we can probably suggest that there's better things to come, which is good. But it probably is right to pick up on a few things that we weren't so best pleased with.
Yeah, yeah. But on the offensive side of the ball, I think the one thing I was, and looking at the stats, he went six carries for 18 yards. Rashad Penny looked a little bit more confident, although 3 yards a carry doesn't suggest that in any way. But he seemed to spark the offense more than Carson was in that first 35, 40 minutes of the game. For me, anyway. I don't know what you think on that.
It's funny because I didn't, now that I think about it, I didn't notice him to the point where when you mentioned his name, I thought you were going to say I was disappointed with Rashad Penny. Not because I was, but just because, I don't know, I almost like forgot about his existence.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
I don't know, there was just something about how he ran the ball on Sunday, which kind of popped a little bit.
He looks exciting when he has it.
Yeah.
But I wonder if, like, is he that much more exciting than, like, J.D. McKissic?
Yes. I think he is. I think McKissic was, I think he was a Kaysen Williams who made the team, I think. And obviously we were in New York when he just flashed with that speed, but I think Richard Penny, I think CJ Procise. I mean, Procise and the rookie from Miami, can't remember his name. They didn't even get a touch or carry or anything. I don't know what the snaps were on Sunday, which is something else. But on the defensive side, Adam, Javon Clowney is a bit fun, isn't he?
Very exciting first quarter. I mean, I'm going to temper it because I think I jinxed him a bit by saying that he's the greatest man that ever lived after he had the pass breakup on the screen past the Joe Mixon. And I don't think he had another meaningful play after that, so I think I may have done him in ever so slightly. Or he did have another meaningful kind of flashy play, but his obviously he was in Andy Dalton's lap most of the day, to be honest.
Yeah.
It's just exciting to have a player like that just out there for you.
Yeah. And obviously next to him, Quinton Jefferson had his coming out party, 2 sacks, 6 tackles, 3 quarterback hits, and even had 2 pass deflections as well, Adam.
They were as impressive as any of the other plays of all of them, the breakouts. They were amazing. I mean, you know, everyone loves kind of the fat man touchdown thing, but seeing a guy like that, you know, get himself up to what he did to bat a couple of passes down from Andy Dalton, who's not, you know, he's not Kyler Murray size. He's a big bloke, Andy Dalton. It was amazing. And, you know, he's the kind of player that, you know, let's say you're an 8-8 team for the sake of argument. He's the kind of player that you need to turn 8-8 into 10-6.
Yeah.
You know, he was one of the players that I would say turned a loss into a win, really, because really, if you looked at those games in isolation, there was a great post on from one of the NFL writers where he said that, you know, if you just take the team names away and the score at the end, you would think that the Seahawks were the plucky underdogs that got taken to town by the more experienced and more talented Bengals team. And, you know, you need those great plays to turn what would look otherwise like a loss into a win.
Yeah, one other thing on the Bengals, obviously we spoke about Dalton getting 400 and quite a few of those yards, Adam, on two. Well, one, the flea flicker was just awesome. And it's really, really cool from Zach Taylor and all that in the Bengals sideline. But John Ross whacking up the W in the Seahawks end zone, and that kind of stung a bit. But as a Husky fan, outside of anything else, and seeing his stat sheet, it is pretty cool to finally see and finally get that from a guy obviously we've been pretty big on and pretty hyped for when he was a Husky coming into the league, Adam.
Yeah, I would say the dream result for us was going to be a Seahawk win and a John Ross coming out party. Yeah. So I'm absolutely delighted for the guy, and I really hope that he can turn this into something special. You know, there's probably two more weeks without AJ Green, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
And but it just shows like how much of a difference a quality coach can make. You know, if you have a guy that actually gives a shit about scheming players open like Taylor did. I mean, I was hugely impressed with the Bengals overall, given what people thought they were going to be and what we were expecting. We were 9-point. I think we were the highest spread
we
game.
Were, yeah.
So, you know, credit Sean Taylor, who it is Zach, Sean Taylor, or Zach, sorry, Zach Taylor, it. Of course it's. Credit Zach Taylor, who gets so much credit that I forgot his own name, for, you know, doing a really good job. And I think, you know, who would have thought that going into week two that the Bengals and the Ravens would be seen as the more optimistic team in the AFC North? Because probably not me a week ago.
No, I don't think many people did even enter that fourth quarter in Cleveland on Sunday. But yeah, one surprise on either side of the ball quickly that we haven't...
A good question. Let's go one to praise that we haven't talked about on the offense. There's not a lot there, is there? let's you know, we've not mentioned him for probably the first time ever this long to a podcast. Quarterback played a nice clean game and picked up the passes when he needed, and it's another fourth quarter turnaround, even if it was only on the first play. But
yeah,
you know, got the job done as he always does.
Yeah, a clean game is what we could ask. I think Dwayne Brown kind of, as we mentioned, we're talking about Justin Britt. I think that left side with Posich, minus a couple of when he was Posich was blurred up, and the one time when he turned around and ended up pretty much just sacking, tackling Russell Wilson himself. I think that left side was a bit of an encouragement. I think especially comparative to the two guys further along, when Britt and Fluker, and to a lesser extent, Feddy. I think Dwayne Brown is kind of, he's going to be the person who's going to have to drag that O-line through what hopefully isn't a funk, but what could be a funk. One to praise on defensive side, Adam?
Because he's not been mentioned apart from very briefly, you know, Wagner just holds that run defense together.
There's
one screenplay to which they show from a perfect angle, and you know, Dalton just pops, you know, just drop, dumps it off to Mixon.
Yeah.
And Wagner's called it 3 weeks ago. Yeah. And you can just see him read it. It's like, yeah, that's going there. Thank you very much. Gobble, 1 yard gain. When, you know, against the Seahawks, if that was a non-Bobby Wagner team, you know, it's probably going for 8 or 9 yards. It was a nice design, but Wagner's just seen it so early. And like, as well as, you know, never missing a tackle, which we completely take for granted, because he's a machine tackling. Just his diagnosis of stuff is amazing. And like, I don't watch much tape. I don't watch enough tape. But you could happily sit me down for an hour just to watch what he does and how he reads and diagnoses stuff, because it's incredible.
Yeah, there's a screen grab from one of the Bengals guys, The Athletic. He goes, "This is what every mix and run play looked like," and it's just mix and one on one.
Yeah.
And all you can see is Bobby Wagner just waiting for me in that hole, and he pretty much just did not get many more yards after the screen grab and the freeze frame.
It was amazing. It's unbelievable. The other 10 players on both teams were out of the play, basically, like doing their jobs, blocking or whatever. And it was 1v1, like playing British Bulldog in the playground. It was like, right, what are you going to do? And he just got him and pulled him down. It was incredible.
Yeah, and I think for me on the defensive side is Al Woods. I mean, they give it as a fumble recovery, which seems a little strange, but he nearly, I think he did, have his hands on his first career interceptions, and then he kind of is that veteran rotation guy, which you kind of see. And also, Rasheen Green and iced the game with that strip sack forced fumble, which wasn't a fumble. That was a weird happening from the referees and then the office in New York. But Rasheen Green, Rasheen Green in his first game of his second year, a year where we kind of need, and especially in his first couple of months of the season, need him to step up. He did, and with a Cliff Averill-like play, Adam.
Yeah, that was great to see. And, it's fun watching kind of the smaller guys who are just kind of full tank mode, just getting around the edge and whatever. They're fun to watch.
Yeah.
And on that note, we have to hope that Poonam Ford's injury isn't going to be too long-term, because that could be a real shame.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it's anything longer than this week, if that, does it?
I guess we'll get the injury report maybe in the middle of this recording.
Yeah. On Seahawks got out with a W, sit at 1-0, and then this week they start their road slate for the 2019 season against a team which they have some links with. We'll move on to that, and we'll welcome a new and special guest this week.
What was your impression?
Well, I was surprised that he came into our interview with his shirt off.
That's right. So Aaron basically got him to take his shirt, Aaron Einline. You know, basically got him to take his shirt off before he went into the interview at the Crown Plaza. That's pretty funny.
You said he can really fire his feet.
Yeah, we're serious. He did. He came in with his shirt off. And it kind of pissed me off, so I took my shirt off too. Not for long, though.
Yeah. Too long.
Much longer than that. Right.
You said he can really...
So, yeah, few teams in the NFL who play each other as uncommonly as the Seahawks and Steelers are inextricably linked together as the two teams are. Lack of forgiveness for a team who had some things go their way back in 2005. Hey, Adam.
Yeah, it wasn't our finest hour. hopefully we can get a bit of revenge, maybe even score a point for the first time in about 21 years.
Yeah, the series against two teams is tied at 9-9. The last time we played, this happened at the end of a shootout in Seattle.
Third and 9, and Jackson's in the backfield.
Yep, and Blitzen.
Here they come. Pass across the middle, and it's caught for the first. It's Baldwin, shaking free and sprinting down the sideline for the touchdown. It's third of the day, Doug Baldwin.
Was one of the better games, and obviously hearing Doug Baldwin score touchdowns at this juncture, Adam, is somewhat wrenching a little bit, isn't it?
Yeah, it'd be nice to have that back, eh?
Yeah. In Pittsburgh, though, it is a completely different story. The Seahawks have been shut out on their last two visits and haven't scored an offensive touchdown at Heinz Field at all, or in Pittsburgh since September 1998, which was a 14-yard touchdown pass from Warren Moon to Christian Fourier in a 13-10 defeat. On the last two visits, though, Adam, it can only improve, can't it?
You never know. I mean, it wouldn't be the strangest thing to happen if we didn't score another point ever again. No. But let's see. We'll have to hope it'll be a little bit better than that.
Yeah, the Seahawks are 1-8 in road openers in the peak careers, and it doesn't seem to be an easy prospect. But to help us learn more on the 2019 Steelers, our opponents this weekend, we are joined by Stephen Nesbitt. Stephen is a features writer for The Athletic, covering all the sports teams in Pittsburgh. Welcome to the Pedestrian Podcast, Stephen.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Pleasure. It's about time we had someone with a bit of knowledge on this show. So no pressure. But you know, one out of the three of us has to know what the hell they're talking about.
Right, I'll try to elevate the discourse here. I'll do my best.
Okay.
Before we get into this week, just a quick nod to last week. The thing that got made me drop you a message on Twitter was the piece you wrote on Juju Smith-Schuster and how he got to the point he's now at. It's remarkable. Does doing work like that change how you view a narrative or the vibe of a player like down the road, or like when you find out the things and how he got to where he is and how he conducts himself?
I think to some degree it does change my own perception, but I think the most rewarding part of reporting and writing a story like that is that you're able to give a lot of fans insight they never would have had about this particular player. This is Juju Smith-Schuster. He's a 22-year-old receiver. He's now the next guy in line behind Antonio Brown as their next number one receiver. And I had written a short story a couple of years ago, right when, if you recall, he was kind of going viral for his bike getting stolen. He was yeah, biking mm-hmm. to practice. And I got his mom on the phone just to hear, you know, he sounds like a pretty fun kid. And she mentioned pretty early on that, yeah, we actually, for most of his childhood, we were sleeping in a garage at his grandma's house. And I was like, wait, you mean like a literal garage? It's not like a converted garage. It's a bedroom. She's like, no, it really was like, it's just a garage. So I was assigned to do a Juju story this summer. And so I went out to Long Beach, California, where he lives, just south of Los Angeles. And I sat with his mom, who's now his manager. We talked about a lot of things. And then I asked her, any chance that that house is still in the family where you guys used to live? And she said, yeah, my sister lives there now. And she took me over there the next morning. And I can confirm it's just a garage. And they used to have about 25 people living in that house. It was Juju's grandma's house. And so that was kind of I sort of framed this feature around that, because the big question that's going to be lingering and looming over Juju Smith-Schuster is, you know, is he going to be like Antonio Brown? Is he going to develop into a diva, famous, ego-driven, celebrity wide receiver? And he very well might. And, you know, Antonio Brown comes from extremely humble beginnings as well. But you never know how people are going to react. And it seems that Juju has a pretty good head on his shoulders as a a son, a big brother, and a football player.
Yeah, do you think that kind of plays into, like, obviously in Seattle we hear a lot when they draft players, the word they often use is grit. That's the word.
Right.
Do you think that kind of pays into a team with Steelers? Obviously the tradition of winning is so big and so palpable with everything. Do you think that kind of played into them trust in Juju, not only to be a draft pick, but obviously to be the guy moving forward after AB and after, well, probably if a quarterback change happens the next couple of years, being the guy, the franchise's like flagship player? Do you think that
right.
paid into the decision and the trust they have in that, because he comes and has shown he can do the work to get to not go back to where he come from, kind of thing?
Right. Yeah, I think. I don't know if that's what they were thinking when they drafted him, but certainly yeah. I think as they've gotten to know him, because you're going with a pretty limited, for their second round pick, it's a pretty limited research study going yeah. into these guys. I'm sure they had some pretty good character references, and it helps that the AD over at USC was Lynn Swann until pretty recently, and mm-hmm. a former Steeler who certainly can offer some insights. But I do think that once he got here, and once he started pretty quickly benefiting from being on the other side from Antonio Brown, I think they did realize, yeah, he actually does have the tools to be that number one guy. And that, the Steelers are, as much as it's all evolved around Ben these last 15 years, they are a team that's always had some pretty elite receivers, and they need that around him. And whether that's, Hines Ward, you had Santonio Holmes, of course, you had Mike Wallace, you had Emmanuel Sanders at one point, and then Antonio Brown took over the mantle and it turned himself into a, potentially Hall of Fame player. And so, yeah, it's an important position and one of the premier franchises in the NFL. And it's a big spotlight. And I think they're going to find out a lot this year about whether or not Juju is the right man to handle that. We saw in Week one, he was neutralized pretty well, mostly in single coverage by Gilmore, I think it was, of the Patriots. And so we'll see if he needs double teams. We'll see what happens, how the Steelers counterpunch if he is double teamed, and sort of, I guess, what he can make of that position, because he's already halfway through his rookie contract. So next year is his last year under contract. So they sort of have to decide really at the end of this year if they're going to try to extend him and make him that the guy for the next, you know, 7-8 years, whatever they want.
What's the general view coming off the week that the Steelers just had going into the rest of the season? I mean, I was going to say to Stu that as much as it's fun to do your predictions before the season of who's going to finish where, it's kind of pointless, and you actually may be able to make a more interesting prediction having seen week one. Now, I mean, if the Seahawks had their kind of result that the Steelers did in the first week, I can tell you for sure that Twitter would probably have to close down forever because of the heat of the takes coming off some of the 280 characters at plus. But I mean, the Steelers were a team that many people tipped, many good writers had been tipping to make a serious run, maybe even to go to Super Bowl and win it on the basis of, getting rid of the distractions and still having a great quick defense and still having good offensive talent. What's been the view coming off the bump in the road, let's say, that was likely always going to happen against a banner raising New England team?
Right. This was a bit of a reality check, I think, because you're right. Everyone had gotten most people had gotten pretty high on these Steelers heading into this season. Now, of course, if you would have asked any of the Steelers over the summer, if they expected or we're going to guarantee a week one win walking into Foxborough, no, because that's a tough place to win. So at no point was anybody, checking this off as an easy win or a guaranteed win. But now, would you have imagined they're going to lose 33-3? No. And that's where the concern is, it was always maybe even likely that you're going to lose in Foxborough week one. But the way they lost is pretty alarming. And I think one of the larger issues we saw was on the defensive side of the ball. Like you mentioned, the Seahawks haven't had a chance to score any points at Heinz Field in a while. And the way the defense looked, I think if they just do some short crossing patterns, they'll have a handful of touchdowns.
Oh, we won't pass, so you don't have to worry about anything like that. That would suggest a plan and a scheme, so you have nothing to worry about on that front.
So the defense, which they've put a lot of their resources into in recent years, whether it be draft picks or whatnot, and of course this year going and getting Devin Bush with the number 10 pick, they've tried to sell out on this defense, and the first test, of course, against Tom Brady isn't easy. Didn't nearly get enough pressure on him. You saw a lot of linebackers out in coverage and looking pretty targeted by Brady, and that's what he does, right? I mean, he's like a surgeon out there, and he's so precise that he's gonna pick you apart, and he's a quarterback that can actually do that. The running game, Patriots didn't really totally get going in the running game, but they didn't really need to either. So that wasn't really their point of emphasis. So we'll see how the run defense looks next week. But the other on the flip side, of course, 3 points isn't going to win you many games. And the offense looked like it had no clue what it was doing. I think what was lost in all of this offseason prediction is you may have lost the distraction of Antonio Brown, but you also lost Antonio Brown. Mm-hmm. You no longer have a Hall of Fame receiver on the outside. And sure, maybe Juju can step in and take a lot of that job, but now you have no number two Juju, right? You have Dante Moncrief. You have, Ryan Switzer. And they've tried to backfill this a little bit and create some depth at wide receiver, but there's no getting around the fact that you no longer have Antonio Brown, and now the weapons at the disposal of Ben Roethlisberger are, a running game if they can get going. James Conner, certainly they want to get him out of the backfield in some passing downs. But it's Juju Smith-Schuster, James Washington, Dante Moncrief, Ryan Switzer, and that's kind of the end of the list there at wide receivers. Not nearly as daunting as it was a year ago. And then if they didn't really get the tight ends involved at all either. So it was a pretty perplexing offensive performance, and the Patriots have made a lot of teams look bad over the years, but to do that in week one, I think is what has a lot of people shaking their heads. And the team, to their credit, I think they're shaking it off pretty well. They seem to be, at least, because in the end, it is one game. It is one game. You were there was a high probability you were going to lose this game anyway, And so if you can sort of shower this off and reset, then maybe it, you know, in the end it doesn't matter all that much.
Is it a team and a staff that is like has a set or set in their ways of an offensive and defensive approach, and they pick guys for that, or do they pick guys and then find the best ways to use them? Because obviously, I mean, the wide receivers you listed, Hines Ward, Santonio Holmes, Emmanuel Sanders, Antonio Brown, Juju, and you got Deontay Johnson was the guy in the mid round this year. I mean, that's a remarkable run of mid round success stories of wide receivers. Are they as entrenched in an offensive and defensive approach as we, myself and all Seahawks fans, gripe about our team? Is that the same for the Steelers?
Yeah, I mean, they know their identity at this point, and they stick to it pretty close. I mean, this is an organization that is slow to change, mm-hmm. as you've seen with them having just like three head coaches over the last zillion years. Yeah. And I do think that as long as Ben Roethlisberger is the quarterback here, this is going to be a pass-heavy team. And he's going to he's going to throw 40 plus times, and they have a running back that they believe can can be a workhorse and has been in the past in James Conner, and they did the same thing with Le'Veon Bell. But this is going to be a team that passes first, and the offensive line has been a real strength of theirs over the last decade. Really, it's been the reason Ben Roethlisberger is still in the league and putting up some huge passing numbers. Is that offensive line has kept him on his feet, and he's not a quarterback that has much mobility anymore, or ever did probably. But you see an issue there. If you don't have the receivers to get that done, then you're going to run into some trouble. And I think an X factor here is going to be Vance McDonald, the tight end. Didn't really get him involved. They got Juju involved pretty late. The only success they had with him was relatively late. And then you saw Dante Moncrief drop four balls, which was the same number he dropped all of last season. So the reasons they didn't get going, could have been a game plan issue, sure. It was also just straight up execution. There was not a whole lot going right there. Didn't get the running game going, and drop passes galore. That's gonna make a pretty long afternoon on offense.
So schematically, I mean, some of the plays that Roethlisberger played, almost like sandlot football to Antonio Brown, and he's famed for, bouncing outside the pocket. And as you say, with his lack of mobility, somehow manages to move himself into positions that he doesn't seem like he should be able to get to, but he does. It was interesting you made a point that they kind of look lost on offense, because in a way, I don't watch them anywhere near as much as you or Steelers fans. Some of the stuff that makes them look at their best in the past has been when they kind of haven't really known what's going on, and they just go to kind of kid playground football, and then an amazing play, normally to Antonio Brown, happens. And is there something to be said that maybe in not having that guy like Brown, who's just have such a synergy with Roethlisberger, it could take a lot of time to kind of get back to what they do with the way that Ben likes to play himself?
Yeah, and that's another thing that probably we forget pretty too easily here is the connection that they did have. Their strife that they had in the end wasn't really it didn't impact their numbers. It was the last game of the season, which of course Antonio never ended up playing. They had a very profitable relationship as quarterback and wide receiver for many years, and one is not the same without the other, I think. And it's going to be hard to replicate that. You're right. The sandlot style, I think Ben Roethlisberger probably led the league in waving at his receivers. You'd see it all the time. He'd look at Antonio, he'd get out of the pocket. And of course, it's like a ticking clock when he gets out of the pocket, because he can't actually run with it. And so it's like, all right, he's got to throw within the next 2 seconds. And then you'd see him wave Antonio downfield, and then he'd throw a bomb, and Antonio's faster than anybody. That as long as he gets a head start or the first step, he's going to beat him. So that is an element that I don't know if we're going to see with this team. I don't know if he has that with Juju, because that is a freelancing, freestyling way that you have to learn that, and that takes some time.
And you got to be a brave young receiver who's trying to get paid to have the risk to do that as well, presumably.
Right. Absolutely. Oh yeah. Absolutely. You're not going to see a rookie step on the field and immediately start breaking off routes because he thinks that's what's the quarterback's going to want, And Ben's a guy who's pretty willing to be vocal when guys make mistakes or run their routes wrong. That's one thing that rubbed Antonio the wrong way last year was, on a radio show, Ben, called out one of his mistakes, I think. And Ben's a guy who has a pretty crucial relationship with the wide receivers, and a, you know, I don't know if he has necessarily the same talent set that he's had in the past, but he's going to have to, you know, figure that out, because this is, no matter how you slice it, this is a team that's going to pass the ball a ton. And I think what's going to happen, honestly, is you're going to see a lot more as they start to get in rhythm. You can see a lot more dump passes off to James Conner and Jalen Samuels coming out of the backfield. We really didn't see much of that at all against New England. New England gets pressure on you quick, and they kind of take away those screens and dump passes. So I think they're going to try like hell to get that going, and then you know, hope that opens up James Washington for a fly route, or opens up Juju for something downfield.
Yeah, with Ben, I mean, you talk about his radio show. He's stopped doing that, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Summer. What's his perception? Obviously, me and Adam have spoke about on our podcast how we think that Russell Wilson has three different voices for different sections and how he wants his approach to things. What's his public persona like day to day in Pittsburgh and on the beat kind of thing?
Yeah, you said Ben, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. He is, honestly, it's with a guy who had so much controversy going on early in his career, of course, with the sexual assault allegations. He was, had certainly, there was checkered coverage of him at the time, and a bit of a wary eye on how long he was gonna last in the spotlight. But as far as what it looks like today, he certainly comes off as a reformed man or reformed person. He's not really spoken much in the last few years about, or not really opened up much of his personal life, his private life. He's married, has a few kids, and so in the locker room, honestly, he is more of a calm presence than anything. He holds court once a week with media, and is you know, relatively engaging. But he's at the point in his career where he's not, you know, gonna go way out of his way for media obligations or anything like that. So. Guys all speak, honestly, guys speak really highly of him as a leader and as a quarterback. I think one thing that Antonio Brown in the offseason pointed out or really made a big stink about was that Ben is treated differently than the rest of the team or other players. And I think
every quarterback is.
I agree. And I think the Steelers would tell you, yeah, he is treated differently. He's a guy who has won Super Bowls, and he's a guy who has been here for so many years at this point. Yeah, we're not going to make him practice every day. We're not going to make him show up to this obligation or that obligation. He's treated differently, and we're just hoping to keep him on his feet and keep him in the league, because we still believe this guy gives us our best chance to win another Super Bowl. So, I think he's pretty well respected within that room. But of course, you're going to have guys like Antonio from time to time who want their slice of the respect pie, and you know, egos don't always necessarily fit in that room.
Yeah, you talked to us with Juju about the stories that they got to the league and everything. I mean, James Conner's one, which is stories well publicized, obviously his battles with cancer and his illnesses. I mean, he went to college in Pittsburgh as well. That's obviously another one which is a good feel, one which can be a massive part of the team going forward as well.
Oh yeah. And if you look at the two guys who have been the most troubled the last 2 years, are Antonio Brown and Le'Veon Bell. Who, however you feel about Le'Veon's, his decisions to sit out without having a guaranteed long-term contract and ends up just sitting out all of last season, regardless of whether you think he was in the right or in the wrong, the team clearly had turned on him and been upset that they believed he was coming, and then he decided not to. And I think there was a time where Le'Veon was planning on coming back to the team and then realized he didn't have to make his money eventually. So you replace those two guys, troublemakers, distractions, whatever the word is, and you replace them with James Conner and Juju Smith-Schuster. I don't know if you could find two, more positive and likable guys at this stage in their careers. They're very different characters. Juju is really, you know, he lives out loud, and he is all over social media, very bubbly, and he's just Juju. And James Conner is a little quieter, keeps to himself a little bit more. Certainly has a tight knit. Crew in the locker room that he's close with, but you're right, he's from Erie, which is about Erie, PA, which is about 2 hours away. He went to college at Pitt right here in town and then got drafted by the Steelers. And another guy who was not a, you know, I think he was what, maybe a third round pick or something, and not a huge bet. And he made it pay off wonderfully in his first year starting last year. And I think they're going to try to lessen his load a little bit this year, getting Jalen Samuels involved a little more often. Week one didn't really show any of that. They had Connor going 10 rushes for 21 yards and then Samuels 2 rushes for 4. So we'll see where that goes, but he's a pretty versatile back who's probably, you know, at his best when he's got a whole head of steam going around the corner and you know, catches a pass in the flat and is able to go, cause he's like a bowling ball. He's a big boy and he gets going fast.
Yeah. He was someone I really wanted the Seahawks to pluck out of college when he entered the league. Adam?
Just to focus on the game itself now, I mean, I can't believe, whenever we have a game that's not in the NFC West, it always amazes me that we're not playing the Panthers, because we seem to play them about 17 times a season. And, you know, obviously we don't get to play teams like the Steelers a lot. And, you know, they're 6 times Lombardi champions. And I don't know, there seems to be like a real like glamour in this game at going into Heinz Field and playing against a team like the Steelers, similar to when we played against the Patriots in Foxborough a few years ago and partly vanquished in no real way, kind of Super Bowl 49, just with a win in Foxborough. Do the Seahawks even kind of really resonate that much over on that side of the country? I mean, there's obviously the constant, you know, moans from stupid people that they don't get enough, the Seahawks don't get enough respect. I don't know why people would care that much about it, but you know, they've been the Seahawks have been a good team for 7 or 8 years now. Is that starting to resonate across one of the more storied franchises, or is it still a case of the Seahawks, you know, just another team coming into Pittsburgh to play?
Oh no, I think there are a lot of fans, and certainly probably on the team too, where it is a pretty uneasy feeling already starting off 0-1 and then having to face the Seahawks, who, even if they aren't nearly the same team they were when they, you know, the bones of the team are probably a lot different than when they won the Super Bowl, and you know, made several deep trips in the playoffs. But at the same time, you have Wilson at quarterback, and that's always going to cause problems. They have a lot of trouble with running quarterbacks here, and we've seen that several times over the last few years. And so I don't think there are many people who feel great about starting off the season Patriots Seahawks. That's not really the way they would have drawn it. I think they would have even welcomed a Browns week one or a week two, even if the Browns are an improved team apparently. I don't think this is the way they would have drawn it up. I think it's the Seahawks have a ton of speed, especially on offense, and I think that's going to be a little worrisome. You know, the running back position isn't really full of burners, but the wide receivers are, and you have the vet in Lockett, and then guys like Metcalf. The Steelers have really struggled with their cornerback situation behind Joe Hayden, who will be certainly, I'd imagine he's on Lockett here. And so I think there's a real possibility that Metcalf burns some people deep, or even a guy I knew a little bit at West Virginia, Gary Jennings Jr., just real speed. And this is a team that drafted in the first round Artie Burns a couple years ago and believed that he was going to be their premier corner, and he's fallen to the fringe of the roster now. And if you can get him lined up in the slot on somebody, then I think there's an opportunity for the Steelers to be real focused on running and stopping the run, and they could get burned over top pretty easily.
After you mentioned earlier, Devin Bush was the pick at number 10. There's a lot I've seen. I think maybe Brian Boulding and people out have said that he's going to add and bring a lot of speed to that defense, and it's going to be that obviously you lacked without Ryan Shazier after his incident. Is that something that they're kind of pinning their hopes on that side of the ball, that his speed will kind of translate to obviously positive impact, but then he could be the leader on that side of the ball in that Shazier absence and hole that was created there?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a Michigan grad, so I watched Devin Bush the last 4 years turn into a bit of a monster at Michigan. And so was really intrigued when they traded up 10 spots and grabbed him. And yeah, that's, you know, he fits the bill of what they're looking for, which is middle linebacker who can really replace Shazier. They tried to, you know, backfill last year and figure out the middle linebacker position and just didn't have it right. And so they said, okay, we gotta draft somebody. And there really were two elite middle linebackers in this draft, in Devin White and Devin Bush. And they figured if they, you know, let him get past 10, he was going to be gone. So, yeah, he's a guy with he doesn't have the size you'd expect as a middle linebacker. He's probably like 5'10 or something, if I'm just guessing. But he's got real elite speed, and his dad was a safety in the NFL. His whole family's got some pretty blazing speed. So he's a guy where you watch him in coverage and he doesn't get beat very, very easily. So they knew in this new age of the NFL, you needed to have a linebacker who can excel in coverage. And they believe they have that in Bush. And it wasn't the cleanest game, his debut, but he still was able to make some plays that made you say, okay, I get it. I get why they decided he's the guy. And I think that's all going to get sorted out as he gets some more experience at this level, at that speed, the gameplay at that level. I think he's going to turn into a good NFL linebacker. But at this point, yeah, he could be exposed, I think, by teams early in the season, especially as he's learning how to captain that defensive core.
So largely because of the soccer team I support, I live my life with a half-empty glass. So if I'm watching week one of the Seahawks, I'm thinking that, you know, Stu and I ran through things that maybe we were a bit concerned with. And one of them was maybe an over-reliance on Chris Carson and a slightly ropey secondary. Now, those are two things that if I look at the Steelers team, who are famed for kind of speed at linebacker, as you say, and also, you know, if we're talking about Ben, you know, able to maybe get outside the pocket and use his receivers for the deep ball, those two things worry me quite a lot. What's your kind of level of optimism, or the general Steelers level of optimism going into this game, kind of the fans that you speak to, based on kind of picking up on things that have come out of week one or the preseason?
Sure. I think the morale, I mean, the vibe is still pretty good here. The Steelers do pretty well. Heinz is a pretty tough place to come in and win. Now it does happen, and the Steelers are known to melt down a few times early in the season. Anytime they face the Jaguars, they really just, you know, forget how to play football. But or the Oakland Raiders last season. So this is going to be an interesting test. I think that people feel pretty good, because I think there's just a lot left in the bag that they didn't use last week. I think everyone's at least hoping that there's more, that they didn't show everything last week and lose by 30. So I think we're going to see a lot more of an insistence on getting that run game going. Again, last week they tried something like, I think it was only around 15 total rushes all game. And that's not really the Steelers' way. They you know, put up a lot of passes, but they also do what they can to feed the run. I think they're going to try to get James Conner going in a way to try to get the safeties to crouch down in the box a little bit more and try to blow them over the top, and catch probably James Washington, but maybe Juju on a deep route. So I think the concern is honestly, today it's more on the offense, but I think long term it's going to be on the defense, because the defense has really been what has prevented this team from taking the next step these last few years. And so I think for right now, people are going to be looking for the offense to explode against the Seahawks. But I think the real question is whether or not they really have the answers in the secondary, especially, and enough of a pass rush to make it work. I think the linebackers will be fine. But I think the secondary, last week you had a guy play a great story, Cameron Kelly. He was a guy who went to San Diego State and then didn't make it on a team last year. And then this spring played in the AAF and was able to make the team out of a training camp for the Steelers and actually started in week one because of an injury to Sean Davis at safety. But clearly they need something more than feel good stories at the, you know, defensive back positions. And so I think that's really the key, is going to be whether they can find five guys who can work back there and really shut down some receivers.
Yeah, we said at the start your job since you're covering all the sports teams. You cover the Pirates before you join the Athletic. Is Pittsburgh a sports town, which kind of is somewhat underrated? Because when you look at the list of teams and you see the standing those teams have in their respective sports, it is quite a similar list to Seattle, really. Also, you got the college sport with Pitt, you got the Steelers, you got the Pirates have been relatively more successful than our baseball team in Seattle have. Is it the sporting appetite is somewhat in that city, which is underrated?
Oh yeah, I mean it's pretty absurd here. You'll go to church on Sunday, and I remember one of my first weeks in town, I went to a new church I'd never been to, and the pastor was wearing, I think it was a Le'Veon Bell jersey as he spoke. This is a place where, like, if you're not wearing Steelers stuff on the weekends, then that's pretty weird, and you stand out. And I come from Michigan, and in the middle of Michigan, which really is college sports country. If anything, it's basically Michigan or Michigan State, you know, what have you. And when I moved to Pittsburgh, it was astounding, because first off, they have what I think is pretty cool, with all three teams having the same colors, black and yellow. And so the Penguins, Pirates, and Steelers, it's great. You can show up to a Penguins game wearing a Pirates shirt, and it doesn't look weird, and no one frowns at you, and it's all pretty cohesive. And so, but you learn pretty quickly that this place is rabid for pro sports, particularly. You know, in this area, there are a lot of Penn State and Pitt fans, but within the city, it's a pro sports city through and through. And yeah, they show up. They certainly do. The Pirates have been the major disappointment over the last couple of decades. Of course, they spent 20 years with no winning seasons, all sub 500, and now they've gotten a little bit back to respectability. But they're not back to the days of the 1970s or championship days, or even the early 90s with Barry Bonds and the like. So, yeah. So they're certainly these fans. When things are good, there are no better fans and more supportive fans. When things are bad, they howl, and they they make life pretty miserable for people like the Pirates owner.
Yeah, so, it's a city definitely high on my list of ones to visit. Adam?
Yeah, so the last question before we pick the game. So I work in food, so all this sports stuff is very interesting and whatever, but let's talk about the stuff that really matters. If I'm a Seahawk fan in Pittsburgh this weekend, I know about Primanti Brothers. I don't know what meat I'm supposed to have there, and I think, is it DeLuca's, the sandwich there? But yeah. Give me two or three meals that any Seahawk fan really needs to be checking out in Pittsburgh, because from what I listen to the Damashek show a lot on the NFL Network, who's obviously talked about Pittsburgh for about 58 of minutes of the hour every time, so you can pick up a few bits and bobs. But where are the spots that these fans need to be checking out if they're on a weekend visit?
If you're there for the weekend, I would definitely recommend going to the Strip District, which is where it really on the weekends is just like there are street vendors everywhere. You can pick up any t-shirts you want, any stuff like that. And there are some great restaurants down there. There's a place called Smallman Galley that I love that has, it's actually a couple different, restaurants in one. So I guess it's almost like a cafeteria feel, but great restaurants. There's a place called Gaucho that is a fan favorite, especially for lunch. You have all sorts of meats. It's an Argentinian place. And then if you dip down to Lawrenceville, there is some awesome food along there too. So there is no shortage of good food options in Pittsburgh. Now everyone does tell you, yes, go to Permane's, get, the cap and cheese, or get, whatever. This might be blasphemy, but I'm not big on Permane's. It's just, there's too much happening on that, sandwich.
They put their chips or the fries in the sandwich, don't they?
They do, and they don't really they don't put any sort of sauce on it, or ketchup, mayonnaise, what aioli, whatever you have. It ends up kind of being a dry sandwich, is what I find. And so I found one thing on the menu that I do, and I don't even remember what it is now. I have to go look, but something on the menu that's a little bit of a pared down sandwich, fries on the side, that I can handle, and I like it. It's a good sandwich, but I don't know. It's I don't know what Permane's did to get this much respect around the world, but as someone who lives here, it's not a place that I intentionally go.
Well, any man who's pulling aioli out as his third condiment is a man whose opinion I trust implicitly on food, and I've made far too much of that this week to even think about it again. But yeah, I'm with you that 100%. So it is a apparently a sports podcast, and apparently we're talking about a game here. So we should probably pick it, Stu. What do you reckon?
Yeah, sure. Adam, do you want to go?
I am going to go for the Seahawks kind of stumbling around a bit in a game that they could win and end up losing, kind of akin to the Cowboys playoff game last year that we all know and love so fondly. And I'm going to go 21-17 Pittsburgh, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think the same. I think this could be a bit like the Broncos game last year. I think 23-20 Steelers. Stephen?
I think the Steelers do find a way to win this one. I think it might be a little ugly initially, but I do think the Steelers offense finds a way to open things up a bit in a way they absolutely were not able to this last week. I would probably put it somewhere around, 30-21, 30-24 range.
Yeah, I think you mentioned, Adam, when we're talking about the Bengals game, I think that kind of why that 1-0 start is so important, because I've kind of had this down as a loss since the schedule came out, Adam.
Yeah, I agree. It's just not one that I expect us to. Yeah, I don't know. Those towels will start waving around, those yellow things, and God knows how they'll react to it.
One more thing on the sports. You mentioned you're alum of Michigan. Do you think what is happening with Jim Harbaugh? He never does seem happy anyway. But the weekend is Army give him a right scare. He was almost looking at his phone waiting for that NFL call to come back.
Yeah, I was actually up. My wife was running a marathon in Erie, PA, and I was watching on my phone. I just couldn't believe it. Yeah, they're going to overtime and then double overtime against Army. I was telling my wife, I said, just hit this field goal, just beat Michigan. They don't deserve to win. Just get it over with. So yeah, there's a whole lot of people upset with Jim Harbaugh. Now, when I was in school, it was the halcyon days of Brady Hoke, and right after Rich Rodriguez had left, and those were not good days. I mean, it was 1 year that was pretty good. They went to the Sugar Bowl, but they were pretty directionless as a program and trying to figure a lot of things out. And so, as I see it, Jim Harbaugh, he certainly is not flawless. You can criticize things he's done, but things are way better than they've been. And I'll take 9-10 and hopefully 11 win seasons, even if it means scratching out a few of these, because ultimately they're as unbeaten as you could have wanted them to be at this point in the season. So yeah. So we'll take that. But there are a lot of people who want I don't know, they want an upgrade from Harbaugh, and I just don't know where I don't know where you go from Harbaugh. Yeah. To get any better.
His next step is probably to come back to the NFL.
You think so?
Yeah.
There's no other college job that you'd expect he'd want, so I think it's got to be NFL.
Yeah, but also at the same time, at least you're not wearing those awful Michigan State unis this year.
Oh God, yeah. my family lives right near Michigan. My parents went to Michigan State, and those are pretty hideous. I saw a couple of my buddies back home were talking themselves into liking those jerseys. I said, you don't have to do that. You can just admit they're bad, and there's no need for a highlighter, lime pants.
First of all, this is an exciting time for our organization.
2017 Browns joined the 2008 Lions as the only teams to go 0-16.
Get in the bin.
Give me Josh Freeman, who was the 17th pick in the first round, over Cam Newton, who was the number one overall pick.
And the 2015 AP Most Valuable Player is Cam Newton.
Get in the bin.
Chip Kelly's an evolver, and he's a smart guy, and I think he's going to go to San Francisco and they're going to be a much more viable football franchise.
That the 49ers are expected to clean house and dismiss head coach Chip Kelly.
Get in the bin.
As we said before we start recording, we do a thing every week, or most weeks, where we put a thing or a person or a theme in the NFL, or sport related if you want, into the collective bin or trash can, colloquially for you.
It's worth saying that people like Hugh Jackson and Marvin Lewis have timeshares in there I think it's probably too easy to even suggest AB at this stage, right? I think I have to put him in as a permanent resident member with a penthouse suite in the bin, unfortunately. So I can't let you off that easily with Antonio Brown.
No, that's fine. I have one. This is near and dear to my heart. It is. I'm tossing Matt Patricia in the bin.
Love it.
As a reformed Lions fan, whose family all still, you know, tolerates the Lions, and my dad follows pretty religiously. Just hideous. Just as you guys say, just rubbish performance. And I couldn't believe. I mean, I turned away from that game when they were. They're up like what 24-6 or something. Yeah. In the fourth quarter, giving up 18 points and just snatching a tie from the jaws of victory in the most just hideous way. And it is a game in which your first round pick TJ Hockenson had gone off. Great debut. Matt Stafford looks pretty good. They'll never be able to protect him like he you know, needs to be protected, but just the way that defense folded against Kyler Murray in the second half, dear Lord, it was ugly. It was ugly. They didn't deserve to even tie, but you know, you'll take a tie just like the Steelers did against the Browns last year. So that's what I'm tossing in the bin is the savior of the Detroit Lions, Matt Patricia.
I think Stuart and I are actually more to blame than anyone because I think we are what the youths would call Daryl Bevel stans.
Yeah.
And if I'm not mistaken, Bevel was the guy that called that horrendous timeout when J.D. McKissic was basically about to ice the game down the right sideline on a dump off. I'm not sure if you saw that, but at 24-6, yeah. I think they dumped off to McKissic. He had a lot of space, and Stuart and I have seen that guy play in the flesh for the Seahawks. He's got a lot of speed. He was away, and bloody Bevel's gone on and called a timeout and tossed the whole game away. So probably our fault, to be honest.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
but there is, I think I said it to you when I was talking about the Texans game either on Monday. There's a vibe all those Belichick coaching tree coaches have, isn't there? And Patricia is the biggest example of that. He's kind of got unwarranted swagger and confidence, isn't he? I think Bill O'Brien's got it to a lesser extent. You've seen it with the guy down in Miami as well.
The best thing I've heard about Matt Patricia is that he has a laminated sheet with his plays on and he has a pencil in his ear.
Yeah, no kidding. Every single game, he's got a pencil on his ear and a laminated sheet.
Adam? I think I'm going to put the players of the Miami Dolphins who apparently want to trade, get out of Miami, like they didn't know this was coming over the past 4 or 5 months. It's been pretty clear from the moment that, pretty much the moment of Brian Flores' introductory press conference, this was how it was going to be on field and that they want out. But then you look at the game film and the defensively especially, it was Bush League at times, wasn't it?
It was horrific.
I mean, Marquise Brown gets a free release 40 yards down the field, and he doesn't really need much invitation to get 40 yards down the field. And it's just they need to take. They knew what was coming. They can't just wail and whine after 1 week in an absolutely horrendous and embarrassing beatdown against a pretty good team.
Yeah, I do have Kenyon Drake in my fantasy team, so if he wouldn't mind getting a move to an actual NFL team, that wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. I appreciate we're pushed for time with our guests, so I'm going to quickly go with mine, and it's one that's come out of a press conference today that it's Matt Nagy who was asked about whether the altitude in Denver was going to make a difference, and he went with the classic faux machismo NFL idea of, it's not going to make any difference to our players, like, we'll just deal with it. I mean, we're talking about oxygen. Like, this isn't just like some random thing that doesn't matter. Like, oxygen is a moderately to fairly important part of exercise. And if you are choosing to play and not acclimatize to a less oxygenated environment, you are really going to struggle. And I just do not understand why these coaches see it as like a sign of weakness. Like, for me, if you're playing in Denver, you should be there on the Monday to acclimatize for the week. I mean, I spent a few days in South America in the Atacama, which is obviously a more extreme version. But I mean, I was like nearly dying after half a day there, just walking around. There must have been some experience that you've seen of coaches, not necessarily on this issue, but just playing the kind of macho card when it just does not need to be played.
Yeah, I'll come right out and say that I think they're flying out Friday or Saturday, and I would look for some huffing and puffing bears because that my brother lives out in Denver, so I've made that trip a few times, and it takes you a couple days, even if you're in elite shape. Not only do you have sort of the circadian rhythm disruption going another time zone away,
You know, it's just a it's some thin air. It's hard to get a full breath. And yeah, I don't like the Bears making that move. I'd get out there as soon as you can.
Yeah, I mean, we saw that last year, didn't we, Adam?
And yeah, we got housed.
We got annihilated. And that's kind of been the theme throughout. I think Ben Baldwin, one of the guys for the Athletic over in Seattle, he's kind of picked up on that Nagy quote and just kind of shaking his head ferociously at it. But yeah, as I said, we are, obviously you've got other things and more important things to do than talk to two idiots from the other side of the Atlantic, Stephen. But we really do appreciate you taking the time. Is where can people find your stuff and obviously all the social media side of it?
Yeah, yeah, I'm on Twitter at Stephen J Nesbitt, StephenJNesbitt, and you can find all my work at theathletic.com.
Yeah, as I said at the start, if no one has. Anyone listening does have a subscription, hasn't read the piece on Juju, we posted up on our Facebook group a couple of days ago when we said you were joining us on the podcast. It's brilliant. This is exactly what people pay, the sort of information and access and stories that people probably pay the subscription to The Athletic to, and why it probably is such a key part and a massive thing, massive positive in that industry, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you guys like it because it's a good home for writing.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, but it must appreciate it, and hopefully, me and Adam are wrong. All three of us are wrong with our predictions come Sunday evening.
It would not surprise me.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's been great fun.
Thanks, guys. Have a good one.
Cheers.
Hi, this is Jessamyn McIntyre, and you're listening to the Pedestrian Podcast.
So, yeah, other Seattle news before we wrap up this week's show. Jamar Taylor, quarterback, has re-signed. Seems that Amadi may have maybe an injury concern moving forward. And the team cut Parry Nickerson, who they traded a seventh-round pick a week ago from the New York Jets. That's a bit of a weird one, isn't it?
Yeah, been a couple of, I guess that classic week one, week two, you know, toss the cornerbacks around from practice squad to sixth-round pick to roster kind of thing. So I guess it's one of those things that always happens this week, and I imagine it will settle down and none of them will ever play a snap for us. But it's kind of that depth that will, with their injury to Nico Thorpe, make them feel a little bit better about themselves.
Yeah, it is, as we said earlier, going to be something a point of emphasis and concern. Any other NFL news catch your eye?
I was going to try and introduce a new segment with you, Stu, that I mentioned to you. Instead of Lock and Shock, something called Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4 in the NFL. So kind of living life in the rearview mirror as opposed to looking forward. So I'm happy to start us off because I've been sitting on someone for a long time, and I mentioned it to you a couple of days ago when we were watching the games. But a good week for Mike Vrabel, who I've got down as the next head coach of the Patriots.
Ooh, yeah, there was a kind of like a weird realization that it was Vrabel coaching that team because he's had 7 months to game plan Baker Mayfield, and it seems that he game planned him perfectly because he made so, especially in that end of third, fourth quarter, he made so many mistakes and so many mental lapses and errors, and that was just because the pressure was on, and that pressure coming from Vrabel. I think the way he's got that defense playing, especially over the first, 20 games of his tenure over there this last season, and this is the first week of this year, he kind of has, what we said with Steven, all the swagger those former Belichick coaches have, but he's the one who kind of stands apart from the others, doesn't he? I mean, McDaniels just seems like he's going to be amazingly let down when Belichick does finally decide to call it a day. And I think you're able to pick Pats could be one, but the offensive side of the ball for the Titans will be the next step. But Derrick Henry seems to have found his feet, doesn't he?
I love watching him play. I know you hate him, but I absolutely love the guy.
Well, I don't hate him. The way he was being hyped, it's a bit like DK Metcalf. The way he's being hyped was just completely unnecessary, but obviously I'm probably wrong about both of them. bad week then?
Well, who's your good week for?
A good week for... So Gardner Minshew, obviously someone we've talked about with Mike Dugal, a few times talked about with Jess... Jesper McIntyre last year covers the Cougars. I mean, if anyone's more suited for South Florida, it is him. And the fact he come in and, only incompletions he had were drops or pass breakups. Coming in for Nick Foles, who's injured, and he's now his team for the next 6 weeks. That team is all of a sudden a little bit more fun to watch because he's such a fun character to track and root for, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that when you reach the elite level of quarterbacking, so much of it is in the top 2 inches, and a lot of that is just believing that you can do it. And you can see the guy is he's a dude. Like he's an absolute leader. And I would imagine it's going to take an awful lot to knock that guy's confidence. He's not even arrogant, but he's just got that belief in himself that you can see through his time in college that he believes he can get it done. And I think that's such a valuable trait for a quarterback to have. And, you know, he's now in a position in Jacksonville where there's not that much that's been expected of him. And if I was a Jacksonville fan, I'd much rather have him play than someone like Cody Kessler. Because at least, you know, I know what I'm getting with Cody Kessler, and it's not going to get me anything that I want. So give the kid a chance and see what happens.
Yeah, I think I completely agree. Also, it just kind of, I mean, 18 months ago, he was the scout team quarterback for Alabama, and then he was a graduate transfer to Washington State. I think he won the college offensive player of the year last year for the Cougars.
He won an award, I think a Johnny Unitas award, I think it was.
Yeah, maybe college quarterback of the season, then maybe not college player of the year. But yeah, he almost got that team into New Year's Six contention pretty much. Just by, I mean, a team which, as we've spoke about and obviously all fully aware of, which is coming off just something which is unimaginably heartbreaking and tragic with all the passing of Tyler Helinski. I mean, he come in after all that happened with a college which was kind of scrambling around a bit, and he kind of brought everything together and made it one of the good field stories last year in college football, and now he's kind of carried that on into being the oldest looking rookie in league history.
There was a picture side by side of him and Tom Brady.
Him and Tom Brady. There, it's amazing.
And it was very funny that the one that looked 25 was the 42-year-old and vice versa.
Yeah, it's amazing. Bad week, Adam?
Got to be famous Jameis, hasn't it? I had a text from friend of the show. Yeah, I'd say friend of the show, Charlie Dagnall, who is not the biggest Jameis Winston fan. And, you know, of all the hype and talk, which I kind of believe that BA, you know, who is a genuine quarterback whisperer, could come in and change the guy. But the way in which he plays, is it's starting to look like a leopard can't change his spots with Jameis Winston. He is just so careless with the ball. You know, San Francisco had 2 interceptions the whole of last season, I believe. That sounds ridiculous, but I believe it was an actual stat. They had 2 pick sixes. I mean, that's seriously bad. And, you know, it is only week one, so we're not going to make enormous platitudes and whatever, but you can't say it looks good for him.
No, not at all. Bad week for me is probably going to be Dan Quinn. Ooh, there's one thing where you need where your hot seat is slightly warming up. A text from me as a Falcons fan. That's probably the worst possible result for DQ in week one. And you went, yep, this isn't going to end well. It just doesn't feel like it's going to end in any other way apart from him being somewhat tossed aside maybe during the season, because that was an abject offensive performance. They got Julio Jones and his $64 million on the outside. Matt Ryan, who's still probably top 10, maybe borderline quarterback in the league.
For sure.
And you got Devonta Freeman, who's kind of, I don't know, he seems to have got off track a little bit, but then you got Moses Sanu, you got Justin Hardy, you've got everything seems to be going for the offense. You got all the players they missed last year on the defensive side from injury, they're all back. And I mean, Kirk Cousins threw for 97 yards and they won by 17 points. Mm-hmm. It was not a good start as we've said before with Seattle, a team which will never get over what happened in the Super Bowl against the Patriots, will they?
No, I mean, Calvin Ridley as well would be a lot of teams' number one receiver. He'd probably be our number one receiver, to be honest.
So I meant not Justin Hardy, Calvin Ridley, but he's Justin Hardy still a Falcons receiver, so I wasn't that wrong.
I mean, they've got so many weapons. I mean, I picked the Falcons to go in there and win, And I couldn't have been much more wrong. That bad week for A. Nathan on the Bigs League. Let's be honest there.
it wasn't a bad week for me. Well, I think I've just realised that after what I said to you and Stephen, that I think I've actually picked the Seahawks this week. So never mind. took a few things I picked wrong. Fantasy football obviously is a big aspect of this sport, this league, for the majority of people, not everyone, obviously. I mean, Marquise Brown sitting on my bench while Devontae Adams is shut out by Kyle Fuller, whichever Fuller is in Chicago. Aaron Jones barely touches the ball. Deshaun Watson decides to throw the 50-yard touchdown bomb to Kenny Stills instead of Will Fuller. It was not a great opening salvo from yours truly. How was fantasy football for you, Adam?
Well, people get very bored about listening to other people's fantasy teams, which I can fully understand, but it is worth pointing out that in three leagues I won all three of my first matches, so at least I'll go 1-12 for the rest of the season in three leagues. So that is delightful.
Yeah, that Marquise Brown was really annoying, all that points on 12 snaps. Anyway, obviously the other main thing, we don't want to spend too much time on it, but Antonio Brown, it is in the words of Dave Niehaus in 1995, it just continues, isn't it, Adam?
It's terrible. I have a lot of sympathy for the Raiders in this situation because I think they've just been played by the whole thing. And
At the same time.
Yeah, you're anti. I think we have slightly different views. Yeah. But for me, the video of Brown finding out about his release, the fact that someone's recorded that, knowing what's going to happen and that reaction, for me, that's just the final straw. And I personally believe he should be in the commissioner's exemption list because I think he's engineered a move that's against the spirit of the league. And I think it sets a dangerous precedent if doing what he's done gets you a move to the team where you want to go to. I think it can start undermining a lot of the process of what's going on.
Well, I agree with that part. But I think, John Gruden was aware of what was happening. He gave permission for them to use that recording of the phone call on the video, which he released. Was it Friday released before it all went down? I mean,
yeah, but that was a video that looked like it was going to stunt, right, week one, let's knuckle down and go.
We've said a lot everyone says a lot about the Seahawks, how married Pete Carroll and George Snyder are. This is what happens when it's the complete opposite. There's a missed connection somewhere between Gruden, Mayock and Mark Davis, because there's no way on this planet all three wanted Antonio Brown. Antonio Brown quite clearly did not want to be an Oakland Raider. As soon as he got into town, he just kind of wanted out immediately. I mean, he just worked everyone. I mean, I'm someone who still watches wrestling, work and shoot is work, shoot. Words which are thrown around quite a lot. He worked everyone. I mean, it might not be for the good of the game and everything, but there's a lot of things which aren't good for certain high-profile sports and games. And this is just something which, I mean, the fact the Patriots signed him when everyone predicted it, and it kind of happened so swiftly. I mean, Pete Carroll said the Seahawks made a phone call and they were told that he's going to the Patriots. So that's how quickly it happened. I mean, Pete Carroll and Schneider are pretty quick to act on things like that. If he had done this to the Seahawks, obviously I'd have probably been completely on your side. But the fact he didn't, I can kind of just see the absolute carnage and chaos and just kind of somewhat enjoy it, I think. Because it is just, it's just ridiculous. It's just batshit. It is everything you can put onto it. But it is at the same time, I mean, it was quite clear what he was doing. As soon as it happened, he kind of sit there and go, oh, yeah, he this is what he wanted all along, and it is kind of what all he wanted all along, and he got it in just the most ridiculous way by putting so many eyes and ears onto it, when really there was already more than enough attention on this Raiders team with Hard Knocks and Gruden and Mark and everything else in that mix last season in Oakland before they go to Vegas. It just, I don't know, it's just a slice of me which kind of enjoyed that absolute bizarreness of it.
I can't disagree too much with that, but on balance, I think that AB should be getting an awful lot more stick than he is, and not that he's not getting his fair share, but if it was a player like, let's say, Cam Newton, for example, was acting like this, can you imagine how mad people would be going?
But at the same time, if Antonio Brown was doing this in Miami, there would not be the same reaction. There'd be exactly the same reaction to AB, but not the reaction to Stephen Ross and Brian Flores as there is to Mayock and Gruden. Yeah, that's all we have this week. Obviously, the Seahawks play the Steelers 6 o'clock UK time, as we talked in depth with Stephen earlier on. If you want to get to us on the podcast, you can. If you want to submit your good weeks and bad weeks, you can on private message on Twitter at Seahawkers UK, Facebook UK Seattle Seahawks fans, UK Seahawkers on Instagram, and thepedestrianpodcast.podbean.com. In week 3, the Seahawks return back to Seattle to face the Saints. They will be providing all the fun and happiness that Drew Brees and Michael Thomas and Alvin Kamara will bring with them from the deep south. But until next time, this has been the Pedestrian Podcast.
Go Hawks!
Coach Carroll, talked to me before the game. It was like, the ball's in the air, it's mine. So just having that mentality, I'm already big enough. So just going up and just trusting my technique and trusting my work, that's pretty much all it is.